One Good Turn. In the first week of June 1893, Ferris's men began prying the last timbers and planks from the falsework that had encased and supported the big wheel during its assembly. The topmost rim arced through the sky at a height of about 25 stories, higher than Burnham's Masonic Temple, the city's tallest skyscraper. None of the 36 cars had been hung. They stood on the ground like the coaches of a derailed train, but the wheel itself was ready for its first rotation. Standing by itself, unbraced, Ferris's wheel looked dangerously fragile. It is impossible for the non-mechanical mind to understand how such a brobding nag continues to keep itself erect, wrote Julian Hawthorne, son of Nathaniel. It has no visible means of support, none that appear adequate. The spokes look like cobwebs. They are after the fashion of those on the newest make of bicycles. On Thursday, June 8th, Luther Rice signaled the firemen at the big steam boilers 700 feet away on Lexington Avenue, outside the Midway, to build steam and fill the 10-inch underground mains. Once the boilers reached suitable pressure, Rice nodded to an engineer in the pit under the wheel, and steam whooshed into the pistons of its twin 1,000-horsepower engines. The drive sprockets turned smoothly and quietly. Rice ordered the engine stopped. Next, workers attached the 10-ton chain to the sprockets and to a receiving sprocket at the wheel. Rice sent a telegram to Ferris at his office in the Hamilton Building in Pittsburgh. Engines have steam on and are working satisfactorily. Sprocket chain connected up and are ready to turn wheel. Ferris was unable to go to Chicago himself, but sent his partner W.F. Grunau to supervise the first turn. In the early morning of Friday, June 9th, as his train passed through the south side, Grunau saw how the great wheel towered over everything in its vicinity, just as Eiffel's creation did in Paris. The exclamations of fellow passengers as to the wheel's size and apparent fragility filled him with a mixture of pride and anxiety. Ferris, himself fed up with construction delays and Burnham's pestering, had told Grunau to turn the wheel or tear it off the tower. Last-minute adjustments and inspections took up most of Friday, but just before dusk, Rice told Grunau that everything appeared to be ready. "I did not trust myself to speak," Grunau said, so merely nodded to start. He was anxious to see if the wheel worked, but at the same time, would gladly have assented to postpone the trial. Nothing remained but to admit steam and see what happened. Never had anyone built such a gigantic wheel. That it would turn without crushing its bearings and rotate smoothly and true were engineering hopes supported only by calculations that reflected known qualities of iron and steel. No structure ever had been subjected to the unique stresses that would come to bear upon and within the wheel once in motion. Ferris's pretty wife, Margaret, stood nearby, flushed with excitement. Grunau believed she was experiencing the same magnitude of mental strain as he. "Suddenly I was aroused from these thoughts by a most horrible noise," he said. A growl tore through the sky and caused everyone in the vicinity, the Algerians of Bloom's village, the Egyptians and Persians, and every visitor within 100 yards, to halt and stare at the wheel. "Looking up," Grunau said, "I saw the wheel move slowly." "What can be the matter? What is this horrible noise?" Grunau ran to Rice, who stood in the engine pit monitoring pressures and the play of shafts and shunts. Grunau expected to see Rice hurriedly trying to shut down the engine, but Rice looked unconcerned. Rice explained that he had merely tested the wheel's braking system, which consisted of a band of steel wrapped around the axle. The test alone had caused the wheel to move 1/8 of its circumference. The noise, Rice said, was only the sound of rust being scraped off the band. The engineer in the pit released the brake and engaged the drive gears. The sprockets began to turn, the chain to advance. By now, many of the occupants of the Algerian village and street in Cairo, and performers from the Persian theater, possibly even a few belly dancers, had gathered on the wheel's loading platforms, which were staged like steps so that eventually 6 cars could be loaded at a time. Everyone was silent. As the wheel began to turn, loose nuts and bolts and a couple of wrenches rained from its hub and spokes. The wheel had consumed 28,416 pounds of bolts in its assembly. Someone was bound to forget something. Unmindful of this steel downpour, the villagers cheered and began dancing on the platforms. Some played instruments. The workmen who had risked their lives building the wheel now risked them again and climbed aboard the moving frame. No carriages were as yet placed in position, Granau said, but this did not deter the men, for they clambered among the spokes and sat upon the crown of the wheel, as easy as I am sitting in this chair. The wheel needed 20 minutes for a single revolution. Only when it had completed its first full turn did Granau feel the test had been successful, at which point, he said, I could have yelled out loud for joy. Mrs. Ferris shook his hand. The crowd cheered. Rice telegraphed Ferris, who had been waiting all day for word of the test, his anxiety rising with each hour. The Pittsburgh office of Western Union received the cable at 9:10 p.m., and a blue-suited messenger raced through the cool spring night to bring it to Ferris. Rice had written, "The last coupling and final adjustment was made, and steam turned on at 6 o'clock this evening. One complete revolution of the big wheel was made, everything working satisfactory. 20 minutes' time was taken for the revolution. I congratulate you upon it. Complete success. Midway is wildly enthusiastic." The next day, Saturday, June 10th, Ferris cabled Rice, "Your telegram stating that first revolution of wheel had been made last night at 6 o'clock, and that same was successful in every way, has caused great joy in this entire camp. I wish to congratulate you in all respects in this matter, and ask that you rush the putting in of cars working day and night. If you can't put the cars in at night, Babbitt the car bearings at night, so as to keep ahead." By Babbitt, he no doubt meant the installation of the metal casings in which bearings sit. The wheel had worked, but Ferris, Granau, and Rice all knew that far more important tests lay ahead. Beginning that Saturday, workers would begin hanging cars, thus placing upon the wheel its first serious stresses. Each of the 36 cars weighed 13 tons, for a total of just under 1 million pounds. And that did not include the 200,000 pounds of additional live load that would be added as passengers filled the cars. On Saturday, soon after receiving Ferris's congratulatory telegram, Rice cabled back that, in fact, the first car already had been hung. Beyond Jackson Park, the first turn of Ferris's wheel drew surprisingly little attention. The city, especially its frappe set, had focused its interest on another event unfolding in Jackson Park, the first visit by Spain's official emissary to the fair, the Infanta Eulalia, the youngest sister of Spain's dead King Alfonso XII and daughter of exiled Queen Isabel II. The visit wasn't going very well. The Infanta was 29 and, in the words of a State Department official, rather handsome, graceful, and bright. She had arrived 2 days earlier by train from New York and been transported immediately to the Palmer House, and there lodged in its most lavish suite. Chicago's boosters saw her visit as the first real opportunity to demonstrate the city's new refinement and prove to the world, or at least to New York, that Chicago was as adept at receiving royalty as it was at turning pig bristles into paintbrushes. The first warning that things might not go as planned should perhaps have been evident in a wire service report cabled from New York, alerting the nation to the scandalous news that the young woman smoked cigarettes. In the afternoon of her first day in Chicago, Tuesday, June 6th, the Infanta had slipped out of her hotel incognito, accompanied by her lady-in-waiting and an aide appointed by President Cleveland. She described her first impressions of Chicago in a letter to her mother. The tremendous contrast between the vastness of the lake, which spreads out as far as the eye can see like a still blue sea, and the unbelievable height of the buildings, some of them with more than 20 floors, creates an immediately unpleasant impression. These great piles of stone kill the poetry and imagination. They bear down on the spirit and on the soul. The buildings would have put her in a bad mood, she wrote, if not for the sheer delight she experienced in moving about the city unrecognized by Chicago's residents. Nothing could be more entertaining, in fact, than to walk among the moving crowds of people who were engaged in reading about me in the newspapers, looking at a picture which looked more or less like me, she wrote. The next morning, Wednesday, Mayor Carter Harrison picked her up and took her to his house for lunch and a reception. Much was made of the fact that Harrison not only had shed his black slouch hat for a gleaming silk topper, but had kissed the Infanta's hand. That night, she had to attend another official ceremony, this one at the home of Harlow N. Higginbotham, who by now had replaced William Baker as president of the exposition. Here, at her insistence, there was no hand-kissing or bowing. While in America, she announced, she would act in accord with American customs. She shook hands. She visited Jackson Park for the first time on Thursday, June 8th, the day Ferris's wheel turned. Mayor Harrison was her escort. Crowds of strangers applauded her as she passed for no other reason than her royal heritage. Newspapers called her the Queen of the Fair and put her visit on the front page. To her, however, it was all very tiresome. She envied the freedom she saw exhibited by Chicago's women. "I realize with some bitterness," she wrote to her mother, "that if this progress ever reaches Spain, it will be too late for me to enjoy it." By the next morning, Friday, she felt she had completed her official duties and was ready to begin enjoying herself. For example, she rejected an invitation from the Committee on Ceremonies and instead, on a whim, went to lunch at the German Village. Chicago society, however, was just getting warmed up. The Infanta was royalty, and by God, she would get the royal treatment. That night, the Infanta was scheduled to attend a reception hosted by Bertha Palmer at the Palmer Mansion on Lakeshore Drive. In preparation, Mrs. Palmer had ordered a throne built on a raised platform. Struck by the similarity between her hostess's name and the name of the hotel in which she was staying, the Infanta made inquiries. Upon discovering that Bertha Palmer was the wife of the hotel's owner, she inflicted a social laceration that Chicago would never forget or forgive. She declared that under no circumstances would she be received by an innkeeper's wife. Diplomacy prevailed, however, and she agreed to attend. Her mood only worsened. With nightfall, the day's heat had given way to heavy rain. By the time Eulalia made it to Mrs. Palmer's front door, her white satin slippers were soaked and her patience for ceremony had been extinguished. She stayed at the function for all of 1 hour, then bolted. The next day, she skipped an official lunch at the administration building and again dined, unannounced, at the German Village. That night, she arrived 1 hour late to a concert at the fair's festival hall that had been arranged solely in her honor. The hall was filled to capacity with members of Chicago's leading families. She stayed only 5 minutes. Resentment began to stain the continuing news coverage of her visit. On Saturday, June 10th, the Tribune sniffed, "Her Highness has a way of discarding programs and following independently the bent of her inclination." The city's papers made repeated reference to her penchant for acting in accord with her own sweet will. In fact, the Infanta was coming to like Chicago. She had loved her time at the fair and seemed especially to like Carter Harrison. She gave him a gold cigarette case inlaid with diamonds. Shortly before her departure, set for Wednesday, June 14th, she wrote to her mother, "I am going to leave Chicago with real regret." Chicago did not regret her leaving. If she had happened to pick up a copy of the Chicago Tribune that Wednesday morning, she would have found an embittered editorial which stated, in part, "Royalty at best is a troublesome customer for Republicans to deal with, and royalty of the Spanish sort is the most troublesome of all. It was their custom to come late and go away early, leaving behind them the general regret that they had not come still later and gone away still earlier, or better still, perhaps, that they had not come at all." Such prose, however, bore the unmistakable whiff of hurt feelings. Chicago had set its table with the finest linen and crystal, not out of any great respect for royalty, but to show the world how fine a table it could set, only to have the guest of honor shun the feast for a lunch of sausage, sauerkraut, and beer. Nanny. Anna Williams, Nanny, arrived from Midlothian, Texas, in mid-June 1893. Texas had been hot and dusty. Chicago was cool and smoky, full of trains and noise. The sisters hugged tearfully and congratulated each other on how fine they looked, and Minnie introduced her husband, Henry Gordon. Harry. He was shorter than Minnie's letters had led Nanny to expect, and not as handsome. But there was something about him that even Minnie's glowing letters had not captured. He exuded warmth and charm. He spoke softly. He touched her in ways that made her glance apologetically at Minnie. Harry listened to the story of her journey from Texas with an attentiveness that made her feel as if she were alone with him in the carriage. Nanny kept looking at his eyes. His warmth and smile and obvious affection for Minnie caused Nanny's suspicions quickly to recede. He did seem to be in love with her. He was cordial and tireless in his efforts to please her, and indeed, to please Nanny as well. He brought gifts of jewelry. He gave Minnie a gold watch and chain specially made by the jeweler in the pharmacy downstairs. Without even thinking about it, Nanny began calling him Brother Harry. First, Minnie and Harry took her on a tour of Chicago. The city's great buildings and lavish homes awed her, but its smoke and darkness and the ever-present scent of rotting garbage repulsed her. Holmes took the sisters to the Union Stockyard, where a tour guide led them into the heart of the slaughter. The guide cautioned that they should watch their feet, lest they slip in blood. They watched as hog after hog was upended and whisked screaming down the cable into the butchering chambers below, where men with blood-caked knives expertly cut their throats. The hogs, some still alive, were dipped next in a vat of boiling water, then scraped clean of bristle, the bristle saved in bins below the scraping tables. Each steaming hog then passed from station to station, where knife men, drenched in blood, made the same few incisions time after time, until, as the hog advanced, slabs of meat began thudding wetly onto the tables. Holmes was unmoved. Minnie and Nanny were horrified, but also strangely thrilled by the efficiency of the carnage. The yards embodied everything Nanny had heard about Chicago and its irresistible, even savage drive toward wealth and power. The great fair came next. They rode the Alley L along 63rd Street. Just before the train entered the fairgrounds, it passed the arena of Buffalo Bill's Wild West. From the elevated trestle, they saw the earthen floor of the arena and the amphitheater seating that surrounded it. They saw his horses and buffalo and an authentic stagecoach. The train passed over the fair's fence, then descended to the terminal at the rear of the transportation building. Brother Harry paid the 50-cent admission for each of them. At the fair's turnstiles, even Holmes could not escape paying cash. Naturally, they first toured the transportation building. They saw the Pullman Company's Ideal of Industry exhibit, with its detailed model of Pullman's company town, which the company extolled as a worker's paradise. In the building's annex, packed with trains and locomotives, they walked the full length of an exact duplicate of the All Pullman New York and Chicago Limited, with its plush chairs and carpeting, crystal glassware, and polished wood walls. At the pavilion of the Inman line, a full-sized slice of an ocean liner towered above them. They exited the building through the great golden door, which arced across the light red face of the building like a gilt rainbow. Now, for the first time, Nanny got a sense of the true, vast scale of the fair. Ahead lay a broad boulevard that skirted on the left the lagoon and wooded island, on the right the tall facades of the mines and electricity buildings. In the distance she saw a train whooshing over the fair's all-electric elevated railway along the park's perimeter. Closer at hand, silent electric launches glided through the lagoon. At the far end of the boulevard, looming like an escarpment in the Rockies, stood the Manufacturers and Liberal Arts Building. White gulls slid across its face. The building was irresistibly huge. Holmes and Minnie took her there next. Once inside, she saw that the building was even more vast than its exterior had led her to believe. A blue haze of human breath and dust blurred the intricate bracing of the ceiling 246 feet above. Halfway to the ceiling, seemingly in midair, were five gigantic electric chandeliers, the largest ever built, each 75 feet in diameter and generating 828,000 candle power. Below the chandeliers spread an indoor city of gilded domes and glittering minarets, mosques, palaces, kiosks, and brilliant pavilions, according to the popular Rand McNally and Company handbook to the World's Columbian Exposition. At the center stood a clock tower, the tallest of the interior structures, rising to a height of 120 feet. Its self-winding clock told the time in days, hours, minutes, and seconds from a face 7 feet in diameter. As tall as the tower was, the ceiling was yet another 120 feet above. Minnie stood beaming and proud as Nanny's gaze moved over the interior city and upward to its steel sky. There had to be thousands of exhibits. The prospect of seeing even a fraction of them was daunting. They saw Gobelin tapestries at the French Pavilion, the life mask of Abraham Lincoln at the exhibits of the American Bronze Company. In the United States Pavilion, there were toys, weapons, canes, trunks, every conceivable manufactured product, and a large display of burial hardware, including marble and stone monuments, mausoleums, mantles, caskets, coffins, and miscellaneous other tools and furnishings of the undertaker's trade. Minnie and Nanny rapidly grew tired. They exited with relief onto the terrace over the North Canal and walked into the Court of Honor. Here once again Nanny found herself nearly overwhelmed. It was noon by now, the sun directly overhead. The gold form of the statue of the Republic, Big Mary, stood like a torch aflame. The basin in which the statue's plinth was set glittered with ripples of diamond. At the far end stood 13 tall white columns, the peristyle, with slashes of the blue lake visible between them. The light suffusing the court was so plentiful and intense it hurt their eyes. Many of the people around them donned spectacles with blue lenses. They retreated for lunch. They had innumerable choices. There were lunch counters in most of the main buildings. The Manufacturers Building alone had 10 plus two large restaurants, one German, the other French. The cafe in the Transportation Building on a terrace over the Golden Door was always popular and offered a spectacular view of the Lagoon District. As the day wore on, Holmes brought them chocolate and lemonade and root beer at one of the Heyer's root beer oases that dotted the grounds. They returned to the fair almost daily, 2 weeks being widely considered the minimum needed to cover the fair adequately. One of the most compelling buildings, given the nature of the age, was the electricity building. In its theatorium, they listened to an orchestra playing at that very moment in New York. They watched the moving pictures in Edison's kinetograph. Edison also displayed a strange metal cylinder that could store voices. A man in Europe talks to his wife in America by boxing up a cylinder full of conversation and sending it by express, the Rand McNally guidebook said. A lover talks by the hour into a cylinder, and his sweetheart hears as though the thousand leagues were but a yard. And they saw the first electric chair. They reserved a separate day for the Midway. Nothing in Mississippi or Texas had prepared Nanny for what she now experienced. Belly dancers, camels, a balloon full of hydrogen that carried visitors over 1,000 feet into the sky. Persuaders called to her from raised platforms, seeking to entice her into the Moorish palace with its room of mirrors, its optical illusions, and its eclectic wax museum, where visitors saw figures as diverse as Little Red Riding Hood and Marie Antoinette about to be guillotined. There was color everywhere. The street in Cairo, open now, glowed with soft yellows, pinks, and purples. Even the concession tickets provided a splash of color. Brilliant blue for the Turkish theater, pink for the Lapland village, and mauve for the Venetian gondolas. Sadly, the Ferris wheel was not quite ready. They exited the Midway and strolled slowly south, back to 63rd Street and the Alley L. They were tired, happy, and sated. But Harry promised to bring them back one more time on July 4th for a fireworks display that everyone expected would be the greatest the city had ever witnessed. Brother Harry seemed delighted with Nanny and invited her to stay for the summer. Flattered, she wrote home to request that her big trunk be shipped to the Wrightwood address. Clearly, she had hoped something like this would happen, for she had packed the trunk already. Holmes's assistant, Benjamin Pitizel, also went to the fair. He bought a souvenir for his son Howard, a tin man mounted on a spinning top. It quickly became the boy's favorite possession. Vertigo. As Ferris's men became accustomed to handling the big cars, the process of attaching them to the wheel accelerated. By Sunday evening, June 11th, 6 cars had been hung, an average of 2 a day since the first turn of the wheel. Now it was time for the first test with passengers, and the weather could not have been better. The sun was gold, the sky a darkling blue in the east. Mrs. Ferris insisted on being aboard for the first ride, despite Greenough's attempts to dissuade her. Greenough inspected the wheel to make sure the car would swing without obstruction. The engineer in the pit started the engines and rotated the wheel to bring the test car to one of the platforms. "I did not enter the carriage with the easiest feeling at heart," Greenough said. "I felt squeamish, yet I could not refuse to take the trip. So I put on a bold face and walked into the car." Luther Rice joined them, as did 2 draftsmen and the city of Chicago's former bridge engineer, W.C. Hughes. His wife and daughter also stepped aboard. The car swung gently as the passengers took positions within the car. Glass had not yet been installed in its generous windows, nor had the iron grill that would cover the glass. As soon as the last passenger had entered, Rice casually nodded to the engineer, and the wheel began to move. Instinctively, everyone reached for posts and sills to keep themselves steady. As the wheel turned, the car pivoted on the trunnions that both connected it to the frame and kept it level. "Owing to our car not having made a trip," Greenough said, "the trunnions stuck slightly in their bearings, and a crunching noise resulted, which, in the condition of our nerves, was not pleasant to hear." The car traveled a bit higher, then unexpectedly stopped, raising the question of how everyone aboard would get down if the wheel could not be restarted. Rice and Granau stepped to the unglazed windows to investigate. They looked down over the sill and discovered the problem. The fast-growing crowd of spectators, emboldened by seeing passengers in the first car, had leapt into the next car, ignoring shouts to stay back. Fearful that someone would be hurt or killed, the engineer had stopped the wheel and allowed the passengers to board. Granau estimated that 100 people now occupied the car below. No one sought to kick them out. The wheel again began to move. Ferris had created more than simply an engineering novelty. Like the inventors of the elevator, he had conjured an entirely new physical sensation. Granau's first reaction, soon to change, was disappointment. He had expected to feel something like what he felt when riding a fast elevator, but here he found that if he looked straight ahead, he felt almost nothing. Granau stationed himself at one end of the car to better observe its behavior and the movement of the wheel. When he looked out the side of the car into the passing web of spokes, the car's rapid ascent became apparent. It seemed as if everything was dropping away from us, and the car was still. Standing at the side of the car and looking into the network of iron rods multiplied the peculiar sensation. He advised the others that if they had weak stomachs, they should not do likewise. When the car reached its highest point, 264 feet above the ground, Mrs. Ferris climbed onto a chair and cheered, raising a roar in the following car and on the ground. Soon, however, the passengers became silent. The novelty of the sensation wore off, and the true power of the experience became apparent. It was a most beautiful sight one obtains in the descent of the car, for then the whole fairgrounds is laid before you, Granau said. The view is so grand that all timidity left me, and my watch on the movement of the car was abandoned. The sun had begun its own descent and now cast an orange light over the shorescape. The harbor was dotted with vessels of every description, which appeared mere specks from our exalted position, and the reflected rays of the beautiful sunset cast a gleam upon the surrounding scenery, making a picture lovely to behold. The entire park came into view as an intricate landscape of color, texture, and motion. Lapis lagoons, electric launches trailing veils of diamond, carmine blossoms winking from bulrush and flag. The sight is so inspiring that all conversation stopped, and all were lost in admiration of this grand sight. The equal of it I have never seen, and I doubt very much if I shall again. This reverie was broken as more bolts and nuts bounded down the superstructure onto the car's roof. Spectators still managed to get past the guards and into the following cars, but now Rice shrugged it off. The engineer in the pit kept the wheel running until the failing light made continued operation a danger, but even then thrill-seekers clamored for a chance. Finally, Rice informed those who had shoved their way into the cars that if they remained, he would run them to the top of the wheel and leave them there overnight. This, Granau said, had the desired effect. Immediately after leaving the car, Mrs. Ferris telegraphed her husband details of the success. He cabled back, "God bless you, my dear." The next day, Monday, June 12th, Rice cabled Ferris, "Six more cars hung today. People are wild to ride on wheel, and extra force of guards is required to keep them out." On Tuesday, the total of cars hung reached 21, with only 15 more to add. Burnham, obsessing as always over details, sought to decree the style and location of a fence for the wheel. Burnham wanted an open, perforated fence. Ferris wanted it closed. Ferris was fed up with Burnham's pressure and aesthetic interference. He cabled Luther Rice, "Burnham nor anyone else has any right to dictate whether we shall have a closed or open fence. any more than from an artistic standpoint. Ferris prevailed. The eventual fence was a closed one. At last, all the cars were hung and the wheel was ready for its first paying passengers. Rice wanted to begin accepting riders on Sunday, June 18th, 2 days earlier than planned, but now, with the wheel about to experience its greatest test, a full load of paying passengers, including entire families, Ferris's board of directors urged him to hold off one more day. They cabled Ferris unwise to open wheel to public until opening day because of incompleteness and danger of accidents. Ferris accepted their directive, but with reluctance. Shortly before he left for Chicago, he cabled Rice, "If the board of directors have decided not to run until Wednesday, you may carry out their wishes." It's likely the board had been influenced by an accident that had occurred the previous Wednesday, June 14th, at the Midway's Ice Railway, a descending elliptical track of ice over which two coupled bobsleds full of passengers could reach speeds of 40 miles an hour. The owners had just completed the attraction and begun conducting their first tests with passengers, employees only, when a group of spectators pushed their way into the sleds, 8 in the first, 6 in the second. The interlopers included 3 of Bloom's Algerians, who had come to the railway, one explained, because none of us had ever seen ice. A doubtful story given that the Algerians had just endured one of Chicago's coldest winters. At about 6:45 p.m., the operator released the sleds, and soon they were rocketing along the ice at maximum speed. "It was about sundown when I heard the sleds coming around a curve," said a Colombian guard who witnessed the run. "They seemed to be flying. The first went around the curve. It struck the angle near the west end of the road, but went along all right. The second struck the same point, but it jumped the track. The top of the car, with the people holding tightly to the seats, broke the railing and fell to the ground. As it fell, the sled turned over and the people fell under it." The sled plummeted 15 feet to the ground. One passenger was killed, another, a woman, suffered fractures of her jaw and both wrists. 4 other men, including 2 of the Algerians, sustained contusions. The accident had been tragic and a black mark for the fair, but everyone understood that the Ferris wheel, with 36 cars carrying over 2,000 passengers, embodied the potential for a catastrophe of almost unimaginable scale. Heathen Wanted. Despite his misgivings, Olmsted left the completion of the exposition landscape in the hands of Ulrich and Codman, and took up a schedule of work and travel that was extreme even by his own punishing standards. He traveled through 16 states and by mid-June was back at Vanderbilt's North Carolina estate. Along the way, in rail cars, stations, and hotels, he solicited the views of strangers about the fair while keeping his own identity a secret. The fair's lackluster attendance troubled him and perplexed him. He asked fellow travelers if they had visited the fair yet, and if so, what they had thought of it. But he was especially interested in the opinions of people who had not yet gone. What had they heard? Did they plan to go? What was holding them back? "Everywhere there is growing interest in the exposition," he told Burnham in a June 20th letter from Biltmore. "Everywhere I have found indications that people are planning to go to it." First-hand accounts of the fair were sparking heightened interest. Clergymen who had seen it were working the fair into sermons and lectures. He was delighted to find that what visitors liked best were not the exhibits, but the buildings, waterways, and scenery, and that the fair had surprised them. "People who have gone to the fair have, in the main, found more than the newspapers had led them to expect." He concluded, "There is a rising tidal wave of enthusiasm over the land." But he saw that other factors were exerting a countervailing force. While personal accounts of the fair were enthusiastic, Olmsted wrote, "nearly always incompletenesses are referred to, favoring the idea that much remains to be done, and that the show will be better later. Farmers planned to wait until after harvest. Many people had put off their visits in the expectation that the nation's worsening economic crisis and pressure from Congress eventually would compel the railroads to reduce their Chicago fares. Weather also was an issue. Convinced that Chicago was too hot in July and August, people were postponing their visits until the fall. One of the most pernicious factors, Olmsted found, was the widespread fear that anyone who ventured to Chicago would be fleeced unmercifully, especially in the fair's many restaurants with their extortionate prices. "This complaint is universal and stronger than you in Chicago are aware of, I am sure," he told Burnham. "It comes from rich and poor alike. I think that I have myself paid 10 times as much for lunch at the Exposition as I did a few days ago for an equally good one in Knoxville, Tennessee. The frugal farming class yet to come to the fair will feel this greatly." Olmsted had another reason to worry about high meal prices. "The effect," he wrote, "will be to induce people more and more to bring their food with them, and more to scatter papers and offal on the ground." It was critical now, Olmsted argued, to concentrate on making improvements of a kind most likely to increase the gleam in the stories people took back to their hometowns. "This is the advertising now most important to be developed, that of high-strung, contagious enthusiasm growing from actual excellence. The question being not whether people shall be satisfied, but how much they shall be carried away with admiration and infect others by their unexpected enjoyment of what they found." Toward this end, he wrote, certain obvious flaws needed immediate attention. The Exposition's gravel paths, for example. "There is not a square rod of admirable, hardly one of passable, gravel walk in all of the Exposition ground," he wrote. "It appears probable to me that neither the contractor nor the inspector, whose business it is to keep the contractor up to his duty, can ever have seen a decently good gravel walk, or that they have any idea of what good gravel walks are. What are the defects of your walks?" "Your walks," he says here, "not mine or ours, even though the walks were the responsibility of his own landscape department. In some places there are cobbles or small boulders protruding from the surface, upon which no lady with summer shoes can step without pain. In other places the surface material is such that when damp enough to make it coherent, it becomes slimy, and thus unpleasant to walk upon. Also, without care, the slime is apt to smear shoes and dresses, which materially lessens the comfort of ladies." His voyage to Europe had shown him that a really good gravel path should be as even and clean as a drawing-room floor. The cleanliness of the grounds also fell short of European standards, as he had feared it would. Litter was everywhere, with too few men assigned to clean it up. The fair needed twice as many, he said, and greater scrutiny of their work. "I have seen papers that had been apparently swept off the terraces upon the shrubbery between them and the lagoons," Olmsted wrote. "Such a shirking trick in a workman employed to keep the terraces clean should be a criminal offense." He was bothered, too, by the noise of the few steam vessels that Burnham, over his repeated objections, had authorized to travel the Exposition's waters alongside the electric launches. "The boats are cheap, graceless, clumsy affairs, as much out of place in what people are calling the court of honor of the Exposition as a cow in a flower garden." Olmsted's greatest concern, however, was that the Jackson Park portion of the Exposition simply was not fun. "There is too much appearance of an impatient and tired doing of sightseeing duty, a stint to be got through before it is time to go home. The crowd has a melancholy air in this respect, and strenuous measures should be taken to overcome it." Just as Olmsted sought to conjure an aura of mystery in his landscape, so here he urged the engineering of seemingly accidental moments of charm. Concerts and parades were helpful, but of too stated or programmed a nature. What Olmsted wanted were minor incidents of a less evidently prepared character, less formal, more apparently spontaneous and incidental. He envisioned French horn players on the wooded island, their music drifting across the waters. He wanted Chinese lanterns strung from boats and bridges alike. Why not skipping and dancing masqueraders with tambourines, such as one sees in Italy? Even lemonade peddlers would help if moving about in picturesque dresses, or cake sellers appearing as cooks, with flat cap and in spotless white from top to toe. On nights when big events in Jackson Park drew visitors away from the Midway, could not several of the many varieties of heathen, black, white, and yellow, be cheaply hired to mingle unobtrusively but in full native costume with the crowd on the main court? When Burnham read Olmsted's letter, he must have thought Olmsted had lost his mind. Burnham had devoted the last 2 years of his life to creating an impression of monumental beauty, and now Olmsted wanted to make visitors laugh. Burnham wanted them struck dumb with awe. There would be no skipping and dancing, no heathen. The exposition was a dream city, but it was Burnham's dream. Everywhere it reflected the authoritarian spandrels of his character, from its surfeit of policemen to its strict rules against picking flowers. Nowhere was this as clearly evident as in the fair's restrictions on unauthorized photography. Burnham had given a single photographer, Charles Dudley Arnold, a monopoly over the sale of official photographs of the fair, which arrangement also had the effect of giving Burnham control over the kinds of images that got distributed throughout the country, and explains why neat, well-dressed, upper-class people tended to populate each frame. A second contractor received the exclusive right to rent Kodaks to fair visitors, the Kodak being a new kind of portable camera that eliminated the need for lens and shutter adjustments. In honor of the fair, Kodak called the folding version of its popular model number 4 box camera the Columbus. The photographs these new cameras created were fast becoming known as snapshots, a term originally used by English hunters to describe a quick shot with a gun. Anyone wishing to bring his own Kodak to the fair had to buy a permit for $2, an amount beyond the reach of most visitors. The Midway's street in Cairo imposed an additional $1 fee. An amateur photographer bringing a conventional large camera and the necessary tripod had to pay $10, about what many out-of-town visitors paid for a full day at the fair, including lodging, meals, and admission. One morning, an artist named F. Hopkinson Smith appeared at the fair's 57th Street entrance and presented an entry pass to the guard. Smith squeezed his wood paint box, white umbrella, portable stool, and three-legged easel through the turnstile and set off toward the Court of Honor, hoping to record forever the beauty of the fair and confident that he possessed Charles Atwood's personal authorization to do so. He had gone only a few steps when one of the Colombian guards stopped him. "You can't take that in," the guard said. "Can't take what in?" Smith replied. "That tripod." "What tripod?" The young guard pointed at the easel. "That there tripod that you've got covered up there. Kodaks is $2. Cameras is $10. Smith denied the easel was a tripod. The guard gave him a thin smile. A crowd piled up in the gate behind Smith. One faction, he said, was anxious to throw me over the fence for blocking up the turnstile. The other could not afford the admission fee and urged him to stand his ground. That group, Smith believed, hoped for a fight. With exaggerated slowness, Smith took out his umbrella and opened it, then sat up and carefully adjusted his stool. The guard was not satisfied. He searched Smith's palette, paint rags, and color box. Finding no hidden camera, he consulted a superior, who allowed Smith to enter the grounds. Smith quickly made for the Art Palace, where he planned to sketch the building's interior rotunda. He had just reached the center of the rotunda when another guard touched him on the shoulder. "Sorry, sir, but you can't bring that through here."
"It's not a camera," Smith said.
"I know, sir, but nobody is allowed to copy pictures here. It's let to a Philadelphia concern." Smith walked back outside and moved around the building until he found a place that appealed to him, in the shadow of one of the building's porticos. There he set up his stool and easel and began to work. It was a bright, cool day. A perfect day. Sun fell through the trees and paisleyed the walk. He began sketching. Crisp morning shadow embraced the belly of a giant lion cast in staff. A Venetian gondola eased along the adjacent canal. Olmsted's electric launches glided past. The morning had been salvaged after all. Spectators gathered to watch him work. A ticket taker for the launches, deploying a common expression of the day, told Smith his sketch was way out of sight. Soon a shadow fell across his paper. He looked up to find another Colombian guard blocking his view. "The captain of the guard has sent me to ask by whose order you paint here," he said. Smith stared back, astonished. It was one thing to bar him from sketching inside the building, but outside? Then the absurdity of the inquiry broke over me, Smith recalled. Millions of money spent to develop art in America. A city built, as it were, in a day, the story of whose grandeur and beauty it would take a century to forget. The most exquisite art building of modern, and perhaps of any time, casting its shadow at that very moment over my easel, sheltering and enshrining the marbles and canvases of the greatest masters of modern art, the whole world bidden to come and feast its eyes, and then one of its guests and devotees debarred from paying his tribute on a bit of paper 10 inches square. Smith did not believe it. "Do you really mean, guard, that I cannot paint here without somebody's permission?" The guard was himself astonished at Smith's astonishment. "Yes," he said, and gave Smith a look of pity that suggested that any man who imagined he could paint the grounds with impunity must harbor some underlying mental defect. "You might as well have asked him whether you might break the tail of the lion and carry it away as a souvenir," Smith recalled. He told the guard that Charles Atwood, the fair's supervising architect and designer of the Art Palace, had himself authorized the foray. The guard watched Smith a moment. He opened one button of his tunic and with two fingers drew from within a small notebook and a pencil. He wrote, "Permit of Mr. Atwood." He walked away. Smith returned to his work, hoping to finish before the sun rose high enough to bleach all shadow from the day. For all Burnham's obsession with detail and control, one event at the fair escaped his attention. On June 17th, a small fire occurred in the cold storage building, a castle-like structure at the southwest corner of the grounds built by Hercules Ironworks. Its function was to produce ice, store the perishable goods of exhibitors and restaurants, and operate an ice rink for visitors wishing to experience the novelty of skating in July. The building was a private venture. Burnham had nothing to do with its construction beyond approving its design. Oddly enough, its architect was named Frank P. Burnham, no relation. The fire broke out in the cupola at the top of the central tower, but was controlled quickly and caused only $100 in damage. Even so, the fire prompted insurance underwriters to take a closer look at the building, and what they saw frightened them. A key element of the design had never been installed. 7 insurers canceled their policies. Fire Marshal Edward W. Murphy, acting chief of the World's Fair Fire Department, told a committee of underwriters, "That building gives us more trouble than any structure on the grounds. It is a miserable fire trap and will go up in smoke before long."
No one told Burnham about the fire. No one told him of the cancellations. And no one told him of Murphy's forecast. At last. At 3:30 p.m. on Wednesday, June 21st, 1893, 51 days late, George Washington Gale Ferris took a seat on the speaker's platform built at the base of his wheel. The 40-piece Iowa State Marching Band already had boarded one of the cars and now played My Country, 'Tis of Thee. Mayor Harrison joined Ferris on the platform, as did Bertha Palmer, the entire Chicago City Council, and an assortment of fair officials. Burnham was not present. The cars were fully glazed, and wire grills had been placed over all the windows, so that, as one reporter put it, no crank will have an opportunity to commit suicide from this wheel. No hysterical woman shall jump from a window. Conductors trained to soothe riders who were afraid of heights stood in handsome uniforms at each car's door. The band quieted, the wheel stopped. Speeches followed. Ferris was last to take the podium and happily assured the audience that the man condemned for having wheels in his head had gotten them out of his head and into the heart of the Midway Plaisance. He attributed the success of the enterprise to his wife, Margaret, who stood behind him on the platform, then dedicated the wheel to the engineers of America. Mrs. Ferris gave him a gold whistle, then she and Ferris and the other dignitaries climbed into the first car. Harrison wore his black slouch hat. When Ferris blew the whistle, the Iowa State Band launched into America, and the wheel again began to turn. The group made several circuits, sipping champagne, smoking cigars, then exited the wheel to the cheers of the crowd that now thronged its base. The first paying passengers stepped aboard. The wheel continued rolling with stops only for loading and unloading until 11 o'clock that night. Even with every car full, the wheel never faltered, its bearings never groaned. The Ferris Company was not shy about promoting its founder's accomplishment. In an illustrated pamphlet called The Ferris Wheel Souvenir, the company wrote, "Built in the face of every obstacle, it is an achievement which reflects so much credit upon the inventor that were Mr. Ferris the subject of a monarchy instead of a citizen of a great republic, his honest heart would throb beneath a breast laden with the decorations of royalty." Ferris could not resist tweaking the exposition company for not granting him a concession sooner than it did. "Its failure to appreciate its importance," the souvenir said, "has cost the exposition company many thousands of dollars." This was an understatement. Had the exposition company stood by its original June 1892 concession, rather than waiting until nearly 6 months later, the wheel would have been ready for the fair's May 1st opening. Not only did the exposition lose its 50% share of the wheel's revenue for those 51 days, it lost the boost in overall admission that the wheel likely would have generated and that Burnham so desperately wanted. Instead, it had stood for that month and a half as a vivid advertisement of the fair's incomplete condition. Safety fears lingered, and Ferris did what he could to ease them. The souvenir pamphlet noted that even a full load of passengers had no more effect on the movements or the speed than if they were so many flies. An oddly ungracious allusion. The pamphlet added, "In the construction of this great wheel, every conceivable danger has been calculated and provided for." But Ferris and Greenough had done their jobs too well. The design was so elegant, so adept at exploiting the strength of thin strands of steel, that the wheel appeared incapable of withstanding the stresses placed upon it. The wheel may not have been unsafe, but it looked unsafe. "In truth, it seems too light," a reporter observed. "One fears the slender rods which must support the whole enormous weight are too puny to fulfill their office. One cannot avoid the thought of what would happen if a high wind should come sweeping across the prairie and attack the structure broadside. Would the thin rods be sufficient to sustain not only the enormous weight of the structure and that of the 2,000 passengers who might chance to be in the cars, but the pressure of the wind as well? In 3 weeks, that question would find an answer. Rising wave. And suddenly they began to come. The enthusiasm Olmsted had identified during his travels, though still far from constituting a tidal wave, at last seemed to begin propelling visitors to Jackson Park. By the end of June, even though the railroads still had not dropped their fares, paid attendance at the exposition had more than doubled, with average daily paid attendance for the month rising to 89,170 from May's dismal 37,501. It was still far below the 200,000 daily visitors the fair's planners originally had dreamed of, but the trend was encouraging. From Englewood to the Loop, hotels at last began to fill. The roof garden cafe of the Woman's Building now served 2,000 people a day, 10 times the number it had served on opening day. The resulting volume of garbage overwhelmed its disposal system, which consisted of janitors bumping large barrels of fetid garbage down the same 3 flights of stairs used by customers. The janitors could not use the elevators because Burnham had ordered them turned off after dark to conserve power for the fair's nightly illuminations. As stains and stench accumulated, the restaurant's manager built a chute on the roof and threatened to jettison the garbage directly onto Olmsted's precious lawns. Burnham retracted his order. The fair had become so intensely compelling that one woman, Mrs. Lucille Rodney of Galveston, Texas, walked 1,300 miles along railroad tracks to reach it. "Call it no more the White City on the Lake," wrote Sir Walter Besant, the English historian and novelist, in Cosmopolitan. "It is dreamland." Even Olmsted now seemed happy with it, although, of course, he had his criticisms. He, too, had wanted to manage the first impressions of visitors by having a central entry point. The failure of this idea, he wrote in a formal critique for the Inland Architect, deducted much from the fair's value, although he hastened to add that he was making this criticism not in the least in a complaining way, but as a professional offering guidance to others who might confront a similar problem. He still wished the wooded island had been left alone and decried the unplanned proliferation of concession buildings that intercepted vistas and disturbed spaces intended to serve for the relief of the eye from the 2 nearly constant demands upon attention of the exposition buildings. The effect, he wrote, has been bad. Overall, however, he was pleased, especially with the process of construction. "Really," he wrote, "I think that it is a most satisfactory and encouraging circumstance that it could be found feasible for so many men of technical education and ability to be recruited and suitably organized so quickly and made to work together so well in so short a time. I think it a notable circumstance that there should have been so little friction, so little display of jealousy, envy, and combativeness as has appeared in the progress of this enterprise." He attributed this circumstance to Burnham. "Too high an estimate cannot be placed on the industry, skill, and tact with which this result was secured by the master of us all." Visitors wore their best clothes as if going to church and were surprisingly well behaved. In the 6 months of the fair, the Columbian Guard made only 2,929 arrests, about 16 per day, typically for disorderly conduct, petty theft, and pickpocketing, with pickpockets most favoring the fair's always crowded aquarium. The guard identified 135 ex-convicts and removed them from the grounds. It issued 30 fines for carrying Kodaks without a permit, 37 for taking unauthorized photographs. It investigated the discovery on the grounds of 3 fetuses, a Pinkerton detective assaulting visitors at the Tiffany Pavilion, and a Zulu acting improperly.
In his official report to Burnham, Colonel Rice, commander of the guard, wrote, "With the tens of thousands of employees and the millions of visitors, it must be admitted that our success was phenomenal." With so many people packed among steam engines, giant rotating wheels, horse-drawn fire trucks, and rocketing bobsleds, the fair's ambulances, superintended by a doctor named Gentles, were constantly delivering bruised, bloody, and overheated visitors to the exposition hospital. Over the life of the fair, the hospital treated 11,602 patients, 64 a day, for injuries and ailments that suggest the mundane sufferings of people have not changed very much over the ages. The list included 820 cases of diarrhea, 154 constipation, 21 hemorrhoids, 434 indigestion, 365 foreign bodies in the eyes, 364 severe headaches, 594 episodes of fainting, syncope, and exhaustion, one case of extreme flatulence, and 169 involving teeth that hurt like hell. One of the delights of the fair was never knowing who might turn up beside you at the chocolate Venus de Milo, or at the hearse exhibit, or under the barrel of Krupp's Monster, or who might sit at the table next to yours at the Big Tree Restaurant, or the Philadelphia Cafe, or the Great White Horse Inn, a reproduction of the public house described by Dickens in the Pickwick Papers. Or who might suddenly clutch your arm aboard the Ferris wheel as your car began its ascent. Archduke Ferdinand, described by an escort as being half boor, half tightwad, roamed the grounds incognito, but much preferred the vice districts of Chicago. Indians who had once used hatchets to bare the skulls of white men drifted over from Buffalo Bill's compound, as did Annie Oakley and assorted Cossacks, Hussars, Lancers, and members of the U.S. 6th Cavalry, on temporary furlough, to become actors in Colonel Cody's show. Chief Standing Bear rode the Ferris wheel in full ceremonial headdress, his 200 feathers unruffled. Other Indians rode the enameled wooden horses of the Midway Carousel. There was Paderewski, Houdini, Tesla, Edison, Joplin, Darrow, a Princeton professor named Woodrow Wilson, and a sweet old lady in black summer silk, flowered with forget-me-not blue, named Susan B. Anthony. Burnham met Teddy Roosevelt for lunch. For years after the fair, Burnham used the exclamation, "Bully!" Diamond Jim Brady dined with Lillian Russell and indulged his passion for sweet corn. No one saw Twain. He came to Chicago to see the fair, but got sick and spent 11 days in his hotel room, then left without ever seeing the White City. Of all people. Chance encounters led to magic. Frank Haven Hall, superintendent of the Illinois Institution for the Education of the Blind, unveiled a new device that made plates for printing books in Braille. Previously, Hall had invented a machine capable of typing in Braille, the Hall Braille Writer, which he never patented because he felt profit should not sully the cause of serving the blind. As he stood by his newest machine, a blind girl and her escort approached him. Upon learning that Hall was the man who had invented the typewriter she used so often, the girl put her arms around his neck and gave him a huge hug and kiss. Forever afterward, whenever Hall told this story of how he met Helen Keller, tears would fill his eyes. One day, as the Board of Lady Managers debated whether to support or oppose opening the fair on Sunday, an angry male Sabbatarian confronted Susan B. Anthony in the hall of the Woman's Building to challenge her contention that the fair should remain open. Anthony was not a lady manager and therefore, despite her national stature, could not participate in the board's meeting. Deploying the most shocking analogy he could muster, the clergyman asked Anthony if she'd prefer having a son of hers attend Buffalo Bill's show on Sunday instead of a church. "Yes," she replied. "He would learn far more." To the pious, this exchange confirmed the fundamental wickedness of Anthony's suffragist movement. When Cody learned of it, he was tickled, so much so he immediately sent Anthony a thank you note and invited her to attend his show. He offered her a box at any performance she chose. At the start of the performance, Cody entered the ring on horseback, his long gray hair streaming from under his white hat, the silver trim of his white jacket glinting in the sun. He kicked his horse into a gallop and raced toward Anthony's box. The audience went quiet. He halted his horse in a burst of dirt and dust, removed his hat, and with a great sweeping gesture, bowed until his head nearly touched the horn of his saddle. Anthony stood and returned the bow and, as enthusiastic as a girl, a friend said, waved her handkerchief at Cody. The significance of the moment escaped no one. Here was one of the greatest heroes of America's past, saluting one of the foremost heroes of its future. The encounter brought the audience to its feet in a thunder of applause and cheers. The frontier may indeed have closed at last, as Frederick Jackson Turner proclaimed in his history-making speech at the fair, but for that moment it stood there, glittering in the sun, like the track of a spent tear. There was tragedy. The British draped their elaborate ship model of the HMS Victoria in black bunting. On June 22, 1893, during maneuvers off Tripoli, this marvel of naval technology had been struck by the HMS Camperdown. The Victoria's commander ordered the ship to proceed full speed toward shore, intending to ground her there in accord with standing fleet orders, meant to make it easier to raise a sunken ship. 10 minutes later, her engines still at full steam, the cruiser heeled and sank with many of her crew still trapped below deck. Others lucky enough to have jumped free now found themselves mauled by her whirling propellers or burned to death when her boilers exploded. Screams and shrieks arose, and in the white foam appeared reddened arms and legs and wrenched and torn bodies, a reporter said. Headless trunks were tossed out of the vortex to linger a moment on the surface and sink out of sight. The accident cost 400 lives. The Ferris wheel quickly became the most popular attraction of the exposition. Thousands rode it every day. In the week beginning July 3rd, Ferris sold 61,395 tickets for a gross return of $30,697.50. The exposition company took about half, leaving Ferris an operating profit for that one week of $13,948, equivalent today to about $400,000. There were still questions about the wheel's safety, and unfounded stories circulated about suicides and accidents, including one that alleged that a frightened pug had leapt to its death from one of the car's windows. Not true, the Ferris Company said. The story was the concoction of a reporter, short on news and long on invention. If not for the wheel's windows and iron grates, however, its record might have been different. On one ride, a latent terror of heights suddenly overwhelmed an otherwise peaceful man named Werrett. He was fine until the car began to move. As it rose, he began to feel ill and nearly fainted. There was no way to signal the engineer below to stop the wheel. Werrett staggered in panic from one end of the car to the other, driving passengers before him like scared sheep, according to one account. He began throwing himself at the walls of the car with such power that he managed to bend some of the protective iron. The conductor and several male passengers tried to subdue him, but he shook them off and raced for the door. In accord with the wheel's operating procedures, the conductor had locked the door at the start of the ride. Werrett shook it and broke its glass, but could not get it open. As the car entered its descent, Werrett became calmer and laughed and sobbed with relief, until he realized the wheel was not going to stop. It always made 2 full revolutions. where it again went wild, and again the conductor and his allies subdued him. But they were growing tired. They feared what might happen if Werrett escaped them. Structurally, the car was sound, but its walls, windows, and doors had been designed merely to discourage attempts at self-destruction, not to resist a human pile driver. Already, Werrett had broken glass and bent iron. A woman stepped up and unfastened her skirt. To the astonishment of all aboard, she slipped the skirt off and threw it over Werrett's head, then held it in place while murmuring gentle assurances. The effect was immediate. Werrett became as quiet as an ostrich. A woman disrobing in public, a man with a skirt over his head. The marvels of the fair seemed endless. The exposition was Chicago's great pride. Thanks mainly to Daniel Burnham, the city had proved it could accomplish something marvelous against obstacles that by any measure should have humbled the builders. The sense of ownership was everywhere, and not just among the tens of thousands of citizens who had bought exposition stock. Hilda Satt noticed it in the change that came over her father as he showed her the grounds. He seemed to take a personal pride in the fair, as if he had helped in the planning, she said. As I look back on those days, most people in Chicago felt that way. Chicago was host to the world at that time, and we were part of it all. But the fair did more than simply stoke pride. It gave Chicago a light to hold against the gathering dark of economic calamity. The Erie Railroad wobbled, then collapsed. Next went the Northern Pacific. In Denver, three national banks failed in one day and pulled down an array of other businesses. Fearing a bread riot, city authorities called out the militia. In Chicago, the editors of the Inland Architect tried to be reassuring. Existing conditions are only an accident. Capital is only hidden. Enterprise is only frightened, not beaten. The editors were wrong. In June, two businessmen committed suicide on the same day in the same Chicago hotel, the Metropole. One slit his throat with a razor at 10:30 in the morning. The other learned of the suicide from the hotel barber. That night in his own room, he tied one end of the silk sash of his smoking jacket around his neck, then stretched out on the bed and tied the other end to the bedstead. He rolled off. "Everyone is in a blue fit of terror," wrote Henry Adams, "and each individual thinks himself more ruined than his neighbor." Long before the fair's end, people began mourning its inevitable passage. Mary Hartwell Catherwood wrote, "What shall we do when this wonderland is closed, when it disappears, when the enchantment comes to an end?" One lady manager, Sally Cotton of North Carolina, a mother of six children staying in Chicago for the summer, captured in her diary a common worry, that after seeing the fair, everything will seem small and insignificant. The fair was so perfect, its grace and beauty like an assurance, that for as long as it lasted, nothing truly bad could happen to anyone, anywhere. Independence Day. The morning of July 4th, 1893, broke gray and squally. The weather threatened to dull the elaborate fireworks display that Frank Millet had planned as a further boost for the exposition's attendance, which, despite steady week-to-week increases, still lagged expectation. The sun emerged late in the morning, though squalls continued to sweep Jackson Park through much of the day. By late afternoon, a soft gold light bathed the Court of Honor, and storm clouds walled the northern sky. The storms came no closer. The crowds built quickly. Holmes, Minnie, and Nanny found themselves locked within an immense throng of humid men and women. Many people carried blankets and hampers of food, but quickly found that no room remained to spread a picnic. There were few children. The entire Columbian Guard seemed to be present, their pale blue uniforms standing out like crocuses against black loam. Gradually, the gold light cooled to lavender. Everyone began walking toward the lake. For half a mile along the splendid sweep of the lakefront, men were massed, 100 deep, the Tribune reported. This black sea of people was restless. For hours they sat and waited, filling the air with a strange, uneasy uproar. One man began singing, "Nearer, my God, to thee," and immediately a few thousand people joined in. As darkness fell, everyone watched the sky for the first rockets of the night's display. Thousands of Chinese lanterns hung from trees and railings. Red lights glowed from each car of the Ferris wheel. On the lake, 100 or more ships, yachts, and launches lay at anchor with colored lights on their bows and booms and strung along their rigging. The crowd was ready to cheer for anything. It cheered when the exposition orchestra played "Home Sweet Home," a song that never failed to reduce grown men and women to tears, especially the newest arrivals to the city. It cheered when the lights came on within the court of honor and all the palaces became outlined in gold. It cheered when the big searchlights atop the manufacturer's building began sweeping the crowd, and when colorful plumes of water, peacock feathers, the Tribune called them, began erupting from the McMonnies fountain. At 9 o'clock, however, the crowd hushed. A small, bright light had arisen in the sky to the north and appeared to be drifting along the lakeshore toward the wharf. One of the searchlights found it and revealed it to be a large manned balloon. A light flared well below its basket. In the next instant, bursts of sparks in red, white, and blue formed a huge American flag against the black sky. The balloon and flag drifted overhead. The searchlight followed, its beam clearly outlined in the sulfur cloud that trailed the balloon. Seconds later, rockets began arcing over the lakeshore. Men with flares raced along the beach lighting mortars, as other men aboard barges set off large rotating flares and hurled bombs into the lake, causing the water to explode in extravagant geysers of red, white, and blue. Bombs and rockets followed in intensifying numbers until the climax of the show, when an elaborate wire network erected at Festival Hall on the lakeshore abruptly flared into a giant, explosive portrait of George Washington. The crowd cheered. Everyone began moving at the same time, and soon a great black glacier was moving toward the exits and the stations of the Alley L and Illinois Central. Holmes and the Williams sisters waited hours for their turn to board one of the northbound trains, but the wait did nothing to dampen their spirits. That night, the Oker family heard joking and laughter coming from the upstairs flat at 1220 Wrightwood. There was good reason for the merriment within. Holmes had further sweetened the night with an astonishingly generous offer to Minnie and Nanny. Before bed, Nanny wrote home to her aunt in Texas to tell her the excellent news. "Sister, Brother Harry, and myself will go to Milwaukee tomorrow, and we'll go to Old Orchard Beach, Maine, by way of the St. Lawrence River. We'll visit 2 weeks in Maine, then on to New York. Brother Harry thinks I am talented. He wants me to look around about studying art. Then we will sail for Germany by way of London and Paris. If I like it, I will stay and study art. Brother Harry says you need never trouble any more about me, financially or otherwise. He and sister will see to me. Write me right away," she added, "and address to Chicago, and the letter will be forwarded to me." She said nothing about her trunk, which was still in Midlothian awaiting shipment to Chicago. She would have to get along without it for now. Once it arrived, she could arrange by telegraph to have it forwarded as well, perhaps to Maine or New York, so that she could have all her things in hand for the voyage to Europe. Nanny went to bed that night with her heart still racing from the excitement of the fair and Holmes's surprise. Later, William Capp, an attorney with the Texas firm of Cap and Canty, said Nanny had no property of her own, and such a change as described in her letter meant everything for her. The next morning promised to be pleasant as well, for Holmes had announced he would take Nanny, just her, to Englewood for a brief tour of his World's Fair Hotel. He had to attend to a few last-minute business matters before the departure for Milwaukee. In the meantime, Minnie would ready the Wrightwood flat for whatever tenant happened to rent it next. Holmes was such a charming man. And now that Nanny knew him, she saw that he really was quite handsome. When his marvelous blue eyes caught hers, they seemed to warm her entire body. Minnie had done well indeed. Worry. At the fairgrounds later that night, the ticket men counted their sales and found that for that single day, July 4th, paid attendance had totaled 283,273, far greater than the entire first week of the fair. It was the first clear evidence that Chicago might have created something extraordinary after all, and renewed Burnham's hopes that the fair at last would achieve the level of attendance he had hoped for. But the next day, only 79,034 paying visitors came to see the fair. 3 days later, the number sagged to 44,537. The bankers carrying the fair's debt grew anxious. The fair's auditor already had discovered that Burnham's department had spent over $22 million to build the fair, roughly $725 million in 21st century dollars, more than twice the amount originally planned. The bankers were pressuring the exposition's directors to appoint a retrenchment committee, empowered not just to seek out ways of reducing the fair's expenses, but to execute whatever cost-saving measures it deemed necessary, including layoffs and the elimination of departments and committees. Burnham knew that placing the future of the fair in the hands of bankers would mean its certain failure. The only way to ease the pressure was to boost the total of paid admissions to far higher levels. Estimates held that to avoid financial failure, a humiliation for Chicago's prideful leading men who counted themselves lords of the dollar, the fair would have to sell a minimum of 100,000 tickets a day for the rest of its run. To even have a hope of achieving this, the railroads would have to reduce their fares, and Frank Millet would have to intensify his efforts to attract people from all corners of the country. With the nation's economic depression growing ever more profound, banks failing, suicides multiplying, it seemed an impossibility. And then, things got worse. Claustrophobia. Holmes knew that most, if not all, of his hotel guests would be at the fair. He showed Nanny the drugstore, restaurant, and barber shop, and took her up to the roof to give her a broader view of Englewood and the pretty, tree-shaded neighborhood that surrounded his corner. He ended the tour at his office, where he offered Nanny a seat and excused himself. He picked up a sheaf of papers and began reading. Distractedly, he asked Nanny if she would mind going into the adjacent room, the walk-in vault, to retrieve for him a document he had left inside. Cheerfully, she complied. Holmes followed quietly. At first, it seemed as though the door had closed by accident. The room was utterly without light. Nanny pounded on the door and called for Harry. She listened, then pounded again. She was not frightened, just embarrassed. She did not like the darkness, which was more complete than anything she had ever experienced, far darker, certainly, than any moonless night in Texas. She rapped the door with her knuckles and listened again. The air grew stale. Holmes listened. He sat peacefully in a chair by the wall that separated his office and the vault. Time passed. It was really very peaceful. A soft breeze drifted through the room, cross-ventilation being one of the benefits of a corner office. The breeze, still cool, carried the morning scent of prairie grasses and moist soil.
Nanny removed her shoe and beat the heel against the door. The room was growing warmer. Sweat filmed her face and arms. She guessed that Harry, unaware of her plight, had gone elsewhere in the building. That would explain why he still had not come, despite her pounding. Perhaps he had gone to check on something in the shops below. As she considered this, she became a bit frightened. The room had grown substantially warmer. Catching a clean breath was difficult, and she needed a bathroom. He would be so apologetic. She could not show him how afraid she was. She tried shifting her thoughts to the journey they would begin that afternoon. That she, a Texas schoolmarm, soon would be walking the streets of London and Paris still seemed an impossibility, yet Harry had promised it and made all the arrangements. In just a few hours, she would board a train for the short trip to Milwaukee, and soon afterward she, Minnie, and Harry would be on their way to the lovely, cool valley of the St. Lawrence River between New York and Canada. She saw herself sitting on the spacious porch of some fine riverside hotel, sipping tea and watching the sun descend. She hammered the door again, and now also the wall between the vault and Harry's breeze-filled office. The panic came, as it always did. Holmes imagined Nanny crumpled in a corner. If he chose, he could rush to the door and throw it open, and hold her in his arms and weep with her at the tragedy just barely averted. He could do it at the last minute, in the last few seconds. He could do that. Or he could open the door and look in on Nanny and give her a big smile, just to let her know that this was no accident, then close the door again, slam it, and return to his chair to see what might happen next. Or he could flood the vault, right now, with gas. The hiss and repulsive odor would tell her just as clearly as a smile that something extraordinary was underway. He could do any of these things. He had to concentrate to hear the sobs from within. The airtight fittings, the iron walls, and the mineral wool insulation deadened most of the sound, but he had found with experience that if he listened at the gas pipe, he heard everything much more clearly. This was the time he most craved. It brought him a period of sexual release that seemed to last for hours, even though, in fact, the screams and pleading faded rather quickly. He filled the vault with gas, just to be sure. Holmes returned to the Wrightwood apartment and told Minnie to get ready. Nanny was waiting for them at the castle. He hailed Minnie and kissed her and told her how lucky he was and how much he liked her sister. During the train ride to Englewood, he seemed well rested and at peace, as if he had just ridden his bicycle for miles and miles. 2 days later, on July 7th, the Ochre family received a letter from Henry Gordon stating that he no longer needed the apartment. The letter came as a surprise. The Ochres believed Gordon and the two sisters still occupied the flat. Laura Ochre went upstairs to check. She knocked, heard nothing, then entered. "I do not know how they got out of the house," she said, "but there were evidences of hasty packing, a few books and odds and ends being left lying about. If there had been any writing in the books, all traces were removed, for the fly leaves had been torn out." Also on July 7th, the Wells Fargo agent in Midlothian, Texas, loaded a large trunk into the baggage car of a northbound train. The trunk was addressed to a Miss Nanny Williams, care of H. Gordon, 1220 Wrightwood Avenue, Chicago. The trunk reached the city several days later. A Wells Fargo drayman tried to deliver it to the Wrightwood address but could not locate anyone named Williams or Gordon. He returned the trunk to the Wells Fargo office. No one came to claim it. Holmes called upon an Englewood resident named Cephas Humphrey, who owned his own team and dray and made a living transporting furniture, crates, and other large objects from place to place. Holmes asked him to pick up a box and a trunk. "I want you to come after the stuff about dark," Holmes said, "as I do not care to have the neighbors see it go away." Humphrey showed up as requested. Holmes led him into the castle and upstairs to a windowless room with a heavy door. "It was an awful-looking place," Humphrey said. "There were no windows in it at all, and only a heavy door opening into it. It made my flesh creep to go in there. I felt as if something was wrong, but Mr. Holmes did not give me much time to think about that." The box was a long rectangle made of wood, roughly the dimensions of a coffin. Humphrey carried it down first. Out on the sidewalk, he stood it on end. Holmes, watching from above, rapped hard on the window and called down, "Don't do that. Lay it down flat." Humphreys did so, then walked back upstairs to retrieve the trunk. It was heavy, but its weight gave him no trouble. Holmes instructed him to take the long box to the Union Depot and told him where on the platform to place it. Apparently, Holmes had made prior arrangements with an express agent to pick up the box and load it on a train. He did not disclose its destination. As for the trunk, Humphrey could not recall where he took it, but later evidence suggests he took it to the home of Charles Chapel, near Cook County Hospital. Soon afterward, Holmes brought an unexpected but welcome gift to the family of his assistant, Benjamin Pititzel. He gave Pititzel's wife, Carrie, a collection of dresses, several pairs of shoes, and some hats that had belonged to his cousin, a Miss Minnie Williams, who had gotten married and moved east and no longer needed her old things. He recommended that Carrie cut up the dresses and use the material to make clothing for her three daughters. Carrie was very grateful. Holmes also surprised his caretaker, Pat Quinlan, with a gift. Two sturdy trunks, each bearing the initials M.R.W. Storm and fire. Burnham's work did not cease. The pace at his office did not slow. The fair buildings were complete and all exhibits were in place, but just as surely as silver tarnishes, the fair became subject to the inevitable forces of degradation and decline, and tragedy. On Sunday, July 9th, a day of heat and stillness, the Ferris wheel became one of the most sought-after places to be, as did the basket of the Midway's captive balloon. The balloon, named Chicago, was filled with 100,000 cubic feet of hydrogen and controlled by a tether connected to a winch. By 3 o'clock that afternoon, it had made 35 trips aloft to an altitude of 1,000 feet. As far as the concession's German aerialist was concerned, the day had been a perfect one for ascensions. So still, he estimated, that a plumb line dropped from the basket would have touched the winch directly below. At 3 o'clock, however, the manager of the concession, G.F. Morgan, checked his instruments and noted a sudden decline in barometric pressure, evidence that a storm was forming. He halted the sale of new tickets and ordered his men to reel in the balloon. The operators of the Ferris wheel, he saw, did not take equivalent precautions. The wheel continued to turn. Clouds gathered, the sky purpled, and a breeze rose from the northwest. The sky sagged toward the ground, and a small funnel cloud appeared, which began wobbling south along the lakeshore toward the fair. The Ferris wheel was full of passengers, who watched with mounting concern as the funnel did its own danse du ventre across Jackson Park directly toward the Midway. At the base of the captive balloon, Manager Morgan ordered his men to grab mooring ropes and hang on tight.
Within Jackson Park, the sudden shift from sunlight to darkness drew Burnham outside. A powerful wind reared from all directions. Lunch wraps took flight and wheeled in the air like gulls. The sky seemed to reach into the exposition, and somewhere glass shattered, not the gentle tinkling of a window extinguished by a stone, but the hurt dog yelp of large sheets falling to the ground. In the agriculture building, a giant pane of glass fell from the roof and shattered the table at which, just a few seconds earlier, a young woman had been selling candy. 6 roof panes blew from the manufacturer's building. Exhibitors raced to cover their displays with duck cloth. The wind tore a 40-square-foot segment from the dome of Machinery Hall and lifted the roof off the fair's Hungarian Café. The crew of one of Olmsted's electric launches made a hasty landing to evacuate all passengers and had just begun motoring toward shelter when a burst of wind caught the boat's awning and whipped the 5-ton craft onto its side. The pilot and conductor swam to safety. Giant feathers rocked in the air. The 28 ostriches of the Midway Ostrich Farm bore the loss with their usual aplomb. In the wheel, riders braced themselves. One woman fainted. A passenger later wrote to Engineering News, "It took the combined effort of 2 of us to close the doors tight. The wind blew so hard the raindrops appeared to be flowing almost horizontal instead of vertical." The wheel continued to turn, however, as if no wind were blowing. Passengers felt only a slight vibration. The letter writer, apparently an engineer, estimated the wind deflected the wheel to one side by only 1.5 inches. The riders watched as the wind gripped the adjacent captive balloon and tore it from the men holding it down and briefly yanked Manager Morgan into the sky. The wind pummeled the balloon as if it were an inverted punching bag, then tore it to pieces and cast shreds of its 9,000 yards of silk as far as 0.5 miles away. Morgan took the disaster calmly. "I got some pleasure out of watching the storm come up," he said, "and it was a sight of a lifetime to see the balloon go to pieces, even if it was a costly bit of sightseeing for the people who own stock in the company." Whether the storm had anything to do with the events of the next day, Monday, July 10th, can't be known, but the timing was suspicious. On Monday, shortly after 1 o'clock, as Burnham supervised repairs and crews removed storm debris from the grounds, smoke began to rise from the cupola of the cold storage tower, where the fire of June 17th also had taken light. The tower was made of wood and housed a large iron smokestack, which vented 3 boilers located in the main building below. Paradoxically, heat was required to produce cold. The stack rose to a point 30 inches short of the top of the tower, where an additional iron assembly called a thimble was to have been placed to extend the stack so that it cleared the top completely. The thimble was a crucial part of architect Frank Burnham's design, meant to shield the surrounding wooden walls from the superheated gases exiting the stack. For some reason, however, the contractor had not installed it. The building was like a house whose chimney ended not above the roof, but inside the attic. The first alarm reached the fire department at 1:32 p.m. Engines thundered to the building. 20 firemen, led by Captain James Fitzpatrick, entered the main structure and climbed to its roof. From there, they made their way to the tower and climbed stairs another 70 feet to the tower's exterior balcony. Using ropes, they hauled up a line of hose and a 25-foot ladder. They secured the hose firmly to the tower. Fitzpatrick and his men didn't realize it, but the fire at the top of the tower had set a lethal trap. Fragments of burning debris had fallen into the space between the iron stack and the inner walls of the tower, made of smooth white pine. These flaming brands ignited a fire which, in those narrow confines, soon depleted the available air and extinguished its own flames, leaving in their place a superheated plasma that needed only a fresh supply of oxygen to become explosive. As the firemen on the tower balcony concentrated on the fire above them, a small plume of white smoke appeared at their feet. The fire department rang a second alarm at 1:41 p.m. and activated the big siren at the exposition's machinery hall. Thousands of visitors now moved toward the smoke and packed the lawns and paths surrounding the building. Some brought lunch. Burnham came, as did Davis. The Colombian Guard arrived in force to clear the way for additional engines and ladder wagons. Riders on the Ferris wheel got the clearest, most horrific view of what happened next. Never, the fire department reported, was so terrible a tragedy witnessed by such a sea of agonized faces. Suddenly, flames erupted from the tower at a point about 50 feet below Fitzpatrick and his men. Fresh air rushed into the tower. An explosion followed. To the firemen, according to the department's official report, it appeared as though the gaseous contents of the air shaft surrounding the smokestack had become ignited, and the entire interior of the tower at once became a seething furnace. Fireman John Davis was standing on the balcony with Captain Fitzpatrick and the other men. "I saw there was only one chance, and I made up my mind to take it," Davis said. "I made a leap for the hose and had the good luck to catch it." The rest of the boys seemed transfixed with horror and unable to move. Davis and one other man rowed the hose to the ground. The firemen still on the balcony knew their situation was deadly and began to tell each other goodbye. Witnesses watched them hug and shake hands. Captain Fitzpatrick grabbed a rope and swung down through the fire to the main roof below, where he lay with a fractured leg and internal injuries, half his huge mustache burned away. Other men jumped to their deaths, in some cases penetrating the main roof. Fire Marshal Murphy and two other firemen on the ground climbed a ladder to retrieve Fitzpatrick. They lowered him by rope to colleagues waiting below. He was alive, but fading. In all, the blaze killed 12 firemen and 3 workers. Fitzpatrick died at 9 o'clock that night. The next day, attendance exceeded 100,000. The still-smoking rubble of the cold storage building had proved irresistible. The coroner immediately convened an inquest, during which a jury heard testimony from Daniel Burnham, Frank Burnham, officials of Hercules Ironworks, and various firemen. Daniel Burnham testified he had not known of the previous fire or the omitted thimble, and claimed that since the building was a private concession, he had no authority over its construction beyond approving its design. On Tuesday, July 18th, the jury charged him, Fire Marshal Murphy, and 2 Hercules officers with criminal negligence and referred the charges to a grand jury. Burnham was stunned, but kept his silence. "The attempt to hold you in any degree responsible or censurable for the loss of life is an outrage," wrote Dion Geraldine, his construction superintendent at the fair. "The men who gave this verdict must have been very stupid or sadly misinformed." Under customary procedures, Burnham and the others would have been placed under arrest pending bail, but in this instance even the coroner's office seemed taken aback. The sheriff made no move to arrest the director of works. Burnham posted bond the next morning. With the stink of charred wood still heavy in the air, Burnham closed the roof walks of the transportation and manufacturers buildings and the balconies and upper galleries of the administration building, fearing that a fire in the buildings or among their exhibits could start a panic and cause a tragedy of even greater magnitude. Hundreds of people had crowded the roof walk of the manufacturer's building each day, but their only way down was by elevator. Burnham imagined terrified men, women, and children trying to slide down the glass flanks of the roof and breaking through, then falling 200 feet to the exhibit floor. As if things could not get any blacker, on the same day that the coroner's jury ordered Burnham's arrest, July 18th, the directors of the exposition bowed to bank pressure and voted to establish a retrenchment committee with nearly unrestricted powers to cut costs throughout the fair and appointed 3 cold-eyed men to staff it. A subsequent resolution approved by the fair's board of directors stated that as of August 1st, no expenditures whatever connected with the construction, maintenance, or conduct of the exposition shall be incurred unless authorized by said committee. It was clear from the start that the committee's primary target was Burnham's Department of Works. Equally clear, at least to Burnham, was that the last thing the fair needed right now, as he and Millett continued their fight to boost the rate of paid admissions, a campaign with its own necessary costs, was to have a troika of penny pinchers sitting in judgment on every new expense. Millett had some extraordinary ideas for events in August, including an elaborate midway ball during which fair officials, including Burnham, would dance with Dahomey women and Algerian belly dancers. That the committee would view the expense of this ball and other of Millett's events as frivolous seemed certain. Yet Burnham knew that such expenditures, as well as expenditures on police, garbage removal, and maintenance of roads and lawns, was vital. He feared that the retrenchment committee would cripple the fair for once and for all. Love. The remains of the cold storage fire were still visible as a party of schoolteachers arrived from St. Louis, accompanied by a young reporter. The 24 teachers had won a contest held by the St. Louis Republic, which entitled them to a free stay at the fair at the newspaper's expense. Along with assorted friends and family members, for a total of 40 travelers, they had piled into a luxurious sleeper car named Benares, provided by the Chicago and Alton Railroad. They arrived at Chicago's Union Depot on Monday, July 17th, at 8 o'clock in the morning, and went immediately by carriage to their hotel, the Varsity, located close enough to the fair that from its second-floor balcony, the teachers could see the Ferris wheel, the top of the manufacturer's building, and Big Mary's gilded head. The reporter, Theodore Dreiser, was young and suffused with a garish self-confidence that drew the attention of the young women. He flirted with all, but of course was drawn most to the one woman who seemed least interested, a small, pretty and reserved woman named Sarah Osborne White, whom a past suitor had nicknamed Jug for her tendency to wear brown. She was hardly Dreiser's type. By now he was sexually experienced and in the middle of an entirely physical affair with his landlady. To him, Sarah White exuded an intense something, concealed by an air of supreme innocence and maidenly reserve. Dreiser joined the teachers on the Ferris wheel and accompanied them on a visit to Buffalo Bill's show, where Colonel Cody himself greeted the women and shook hands with each. Dreiser followed the ladies through the manufacturer's building where, he said, a man could trail round from place to place for a year and not get tired. In the midway, Dreiser persuaded James J. Corbett to meet the woman. Corbett was the boxer who had downed John L. Sullivan in the great fight of September 1892, a battle that had consumed the entire front page of the next morning's Chicago Tribune. Corbett, too, shook the women's hands, although one teacher declined the opportunity. Her name was Sullivan. Every chance he got, Dreiser tried to separate Sarah White from the Republic's entourage, which Dreiser called the 40-odd, but Sarah had brought along her equally pretty and far more lively sister, Rose, which complicated things. On at least one occasion, Dreiser tried to kiss Sarah. She told him not to be sentimental. He failed at seduction, but was himself successfully seduced by the fair. It had swept him, he said, into a dream from which I did not recover for months. Most captivating were the nights, when the long shadows have all merged into one and the stars begin to gleam out over the lake and the domes of the palaces of the White City. Sarah White remained on his mind long after he and the 40-odd departed the fair. In St. Louis he wrote to her and courted her, and in the process resolved to make more of himself as a writer. He left St. Louis for a job editing a rural Michigan newspaper, but found the realities of being a small-town editor did not live up to the fantasy. After a few other stops, he reached Pittsburgh. He wrote to Sarah White and visited her whenever he returned to St. Louis. He asked her to sit in his lap. She refused. She did, however, accept his proposal of marriage. Dreiser showed a friend, John Maxwell of the St. Louis Globe Democrat, her photograph. Where Dreiser saw an enticing woman of mystery, Maxwell saw a schoolmarm of drab demeanor. He tried to warn Dreiser. If you marry now, and a conventional and narrow woman at that, one older than you, you're gone. It was good advice for a man like Dreiser, but Dreiser did not take it. The Ferris wheel became a vector for love. Couples asked permission to be married at the highest point on the wheel. Luther Rice never allowed it, but in two cases where the couples already had mailed invitations, he did permit weddings in his office. Despite the wheel's inherent romantic potential, however, rides at night never became popular. The favorite hour was the golden time between 5 and 6 in the evening. Holmes, newly free and land-rich, brought a new woman to the fair, Georgiana Yoke, whom he had met earlier in the year at a department store, Schlesinger and Meyer, where she worked as a saleswoman. She had grown up in Franklin, Indiana, and lived there with her parents until 1891, when she set out for a bigger, more glamorous life in Chicago. She was only 23 when she met Holmes, but her small size and sun-blonde hair made her look much younger, almost like a child, save for the sharp features of her face and the intelligence that inhabited her very large blue eyes. She had never met anyone like him. He was handsome, articulate, and clearly well off. He even possessed property in Europe. She felt a certain sadness for him, however. He was so alone. All his family was dead, save one aunt living in Africa. His last uncle had just died and left him a large fortune comprised of property in the South and in Fort Worth, Texas. Holmes gave her many presents, among them a Bible, diamond earrings, and a locket. A little heart, she said, with pearls. At the fair, he took her on the Ferris wheel and hired a gondola and walked with her on the dark, fragrant paths of the wooded island in the soft glow of Chinese lanterns. He asked her to be his wife. She agreed instantly. He cautioned, however, that for the marriage he would have to use a different name, Henry Mansfield Howard. It was his dead uncle's name, he said. The uncle was blood-proud and had bequeathed Holmes his estate on condition he first adopt the uncle's name in full. Holmes had obliged out of respect for his uncle's memory. Mayor Harrison, too, believed he was in love with a New Orleans woman named Annie Howard. He was 68 and a widower twice over. She was in her 20s. No one knew exactly where in her 20s, but estimates put her between 21 and 27 years old. She was very plump, by one account, and full of life. She had come to Chicago for the duration of the fair and was renting a mansion near the mayor's. She spent her days at the fair buying art. Harrison and Miss Howard had some news for the city, but the mayor had no plans to reveal it until October 28th, when the exposition would host American Cities Day. His day, really. 2 days before the official close, but the day when he would get to stand before several thousand mayors from around the country and revel in his stature as mayor of Chicago, the city that built the greatest fair of all time. Freaks.
On July 31, 1893, after two investigative hearings, the Retrenchment Committee gave its report to the Exposition's Board of Directors. The report stated that the financial management of the fair can only be characterized as shamefully extravagant. Drastic cuts in spending and staff were necessary immediately. As to the construction department, we hardly know what to say, the report continued. We had no time to go into details, but have formed the decided impression that this is being run now, as in the past, upon the general theory that money is no object. The Retrenchment Committee made it clear that, at least for its three members, the financial success of the fair was as important as its obvious aesthetic success. The honor of Chicago's leading men, who prided themselves on their unsentimental, some might say ruthless, pursuit of maximum profit, was in peril. The report closed, "If we are not to be disgraced before the public as businessmen, this matter must be followed up sharply and decisively." In separate statements, the Retrenchment Committee urged the directors to make the committee permanent and invest it with the power to approve or deny every expenditure at the exposition, no matter how small. This was too much, even for the equally hardened businessmen of the exposition board. President Higginbotham said he would resign before he would cede such power to anyone. Other directors felt likewise. Stung by this rejection, the three men of the Retrenchment Committee themselves resigned. One told a reporter, "If the directory had seen fit to continue the committee with power as originally intended, it would have dropped heads enough to fill the Grand Court Basin." The retrencher's report had been too harsh, too much a rebuke, at a time when the mood throughout Chicago was one of sustained exultation at the fact that the fair had gotten built at all, and that it had proven more beautiful than anyone had imagined. Even New York had apologized. Well, at least one editor from New York. Charles T. Root, editor of the New York Dry Goods Reporter, and no relation to Burnham's dead partner, published an editorial on Thursday, August 10, 1893, in which he cited the ridicule and hostility that New York editors had expressed ever since Chicago won the right to build the exposition. Hundreds of newspapers, among them scores of the strongest Eastern dailies, held their sides with merriment over the exquisite humor of the idea of this crude, upstart, pork-packing city undertaking to conceive and carry out a true World's Fair. The carping had subsided, he wrote, but few of the carpers had as yet made the amende honorable that now clearly was due Chicago. He compounded his own heresy by adding that if New York had won the fair, it would not have done as fine a job. So far as I have been able to observe, New York never gets behind any enterprise as Chicago got behind this, and without that splendid pulling together, prestige, financial supremacy, and all that sort of thing would not go far toward paralleling the White City. It was time, he said, to acknowledge the truth. Chicago has disappointed her enemies and astonished the world. None of the exposition directors or officers had any illusions, however. The rate of paid admissions, though rising steadily, had to be increased still more and soon. Only 3 months remained until the closing ceremony on October 30th. The closure was supposed to happen at the end of October, meaning October 31st, but some unidentified crafter of the federal legislation erred in thinking October only had 30 days. The directors stepped up pressure on the railroads to lower fares. The Chicago Tribune made fare reductions a crusade and openly attacked the railroads. "They are unpatriotic, for this is a national, not a local fair," an editorial charged on August 11, 1893. "They are also desperately and utterly selfish." The next day, the newspaper singled out Chauncey Depew, president of the New York Central, for a particularly caustic appraisal. "Mr. Depew all along has posed as the special friend of the World's Fair and has been lavish in his declarations that his roads would do the fair thing and would enable tens of thousands to come here beyond Niagara Falls." Yet Depew had failed to do what he promised, the Tribune said. It is in order for Chauncey M. Depew to hand in his resignation as Chicago's adopted son. Chicago wants no more of him. Frank Millett, meanwhile, stepped up his own efforts to promote the fair and arranged an increasingly exotic series of events. He organized boat races in the basin of the Court of Honor that pitted inhabitants of the Midway villages against one another. They did battle every Tuesday evening in vessels native to their homelands. "We want to do something to liven up the lagoons and basin," Millett told an interviewer. "People are getting tired of looking at the electric launches. If we can get the Turks, the South Sea Islanders, the Cingalese, the Eskimos, and the American Indians to float about the Grand Basin in their native barks, it will certainly add some novelty as well as interest to the scene." Millett also organized swim meets between the Midway types, as the press called them. He scheduled these for Fridays. The first race took place August 11th in the lagoon, with Zulus swimming against South American Indians. The Dahomans also competed, as did the Turks, some of them as hairy as gorillas, the Tribune said, with the anthropological abandon common to the age. The races were notable for the lack of clothing worn by the contestants and the serious way in which they went at the task of winning $5 gold pieces. Millett's big coup was the Great Midway Ball, held on the night of Wednesday, August 16th. The Tribune called it the Ball of the Midway Freaks and sought to whet the nation's appetite with an editorial that first noted a rising furor within the Board of Lady Managers over the belly dancers of the Midway. Whether the apprehensions of the good ladies were due to infringements of morality or to the anticipation that the performers may bring on an attack of peritonitis if they persist in their contortions is not clear. But all the same, they have taken the position that what is not considered very much out of the way on the banks of the Nile or in the marketplaces of Syria is entirely improper on the Midway between Jackson and Washington Parks. But now, the Tribune continued, the belly dancers and every other depraved, jiggling, half-dressed woman of the Midway had been invited to the Great Ball, where they were expected to dance with the senior officers of the fair, including Burnham and Davis. The situation, therefore, as will be seen, is full of horrifying possibilities, the Tribune said. It should cause a shiver in the composite breast of the Board of Lady Managers when they consider what may happen if Director General Davis should lead out some fascinating Fatima at the head of the grand procession, and she should be taken with peritonitis in the midst of the dance, or if Potter Palmer should escort a votary of the Temple of Luxor, only to find her with the same ailment, or if Mayor Harrison, who belongs to all nations, should dance with the whole lot. Will they suppress their partners' contortions by protest or by force, or, following the fashion of the country, will they too attempt Oriental contortions? Suppose that President Higginbotham finds as his vis-a-vis an anointed, barebacked Fiji beauty or a Dahomeyite Amazon bent upon the extraordinary antics of the cannibal dance. Is he to join in and imitate her or risk his head in an effort to restrain her? Further enriching the affair was the presence at Jackson Park of George Francis Train, known universally as Citizen Train, in his white suit, red belt, and red Turkish fez, invited by Millett to host the ball and the boat and swim races, and anything else that Millett could devise. Train was one of the most famous men of the day, though no one knew quite why. He was said to have been the model for Phileas Fogg, the globetrotter in Around the World in 80 Days. Train claimed the real reason he was invited was to save the fair by using his psychic powers to increase attendance. These powers resided in his body in the form of electrical energy. He walked about the fairgrounds rubbing his palms to husband that energy and refused to shake hands with anyone lest the act discharge his potency. Chicago built the fair, he said. Everybody else tried to kill it. Chicago built it. I am here to save it, and I'll be hanged if I haven't. The
The ball took place in the fair's natatorium, a large building on the midway devoted to swimming and bathing, and equipped with a ballroom and banquet rooms. Bunting of yellow and red hung from the ceiling. The galleries that overlooked the ballroom were outfitted with opera boxes for fair officials and socially prominent families. Burnham had a box, as did Davis and Higginbotham, and, of course, the Palmers. The galleries also had seats and standing room for other paying guests. From railings in front of the boxes hung triangles of silk embroidered with gold arabesques, all glowing with the light of adjacent incandescent bulbs. The effect was one of indescribable opulence. The retrenchment committee would not have approved. At 9:15 that night, Citizen Train, dressed in his usual white but now for some reason carrying an armful of blooming sweet pea, led the procession of exotics, many barefoot, down the stairway of the natatorium to the ballroom below. He held the hand of a 10-year-old Mexican ballerina and was followed by scores of men and women in the customary clothing of their native cultures. Saul Bloom kept order on the ballroom floor. The official program dedicated dances to particular officials and guests. Director General Davis was to lead a quadrille, Burnham a berlin, Mayor Harrison a polka. Once the dances were completed, the crowd was to sing Home Sweet Home. It was hot. Chief Rain in the Face, the Sioux chief who killed Custer's brother and now occupied Sitting Bull's cabin in the midway, wore green paint that streamed down his face. A Laplander wore a fur shirt. Eskimo women wore blouses of walrus skin. The Maharaja of Kapurthala, visiting that week from India, sat in a makeshift throne on the ballroom stage, fanned by three servants. The ballroom burst with color and energy. Japanese in red silk, Bedouins in red and black, Romanians in red, blue, and yellow. Women who ordinarily would have come wearing almost nothing, like Ahiz, an Amazon, and Zatubi, a Dahomen, were given short skirts constructed of small American flags. The Tribune, in an unintended parody of its own penchant for describing the gowns of the rich, noted that Lola, a South Sea Islander, wore her native costume of bark cloth covering about half the body, with low-cut and sleeveless bodice. As the night wore on and the wine flowed, the line to dance with Lola grew long. Sadly, the belly dancers came in robes and turbans. Men in black dress suits circled the floor, swinging black Amazons with bushy hair and teeth necklaces. Chicago, and perhaps the world, had never seen anything like it. The Tribune called the ball the strangest gathering since the destruction of the Tower of Babel. There was food, of course. The official menu? Relishes. Hard-boiled potatoes a la Irish Village. International hash a la Midway Plaisance. Cold dishes. Roast missionary a la Dahomey, west coast of Africa. Jerked buffalo a la Indian Village. Stuffed ostrich a la Ostrich Farm. Boiled camel humps a la Cairo Street. Monkey stew a la Hagenbeck. Entrees. Fricassee of reindeer a la Lapland. Fried snowballs a la Ice Railway. Crystallized frappe from Libby Glass Exhibit. Pastry. Wind donuts a la Captive Balloon. Sandwiches, assorted, especially prepared by the Leather Exhibit. And for dessert, the program said, 25% of gross receipts. The ball ended at 4:30 a.m. The exotics walked slowly back to the midway. The guests climbed into their carriages and slept or softly sang After the Ball, the hit song of the day, as their liverymen drove them home over empty streets that echoed with the plosive rhythm of hooves on granite. The ball and Frank Millet's other inventions imparted to the exposition a wilder, happier air. The exposition by day might wear a chaste gown of white staff, but at night it danced barefoot and guzzled champagne. attendance rose. The daily average of paid admissions for August was 113,403, at last topping the vital 100,000 threshold. The margin was slim, however, and the nation's economic depression was growing steadily worse, its labor situation more volatile. On August 3rd, a big Chicago bank, Lazarus Silverman, failed. Burnham's firm had long been a client. On the night of August 10th, Charles J. Eddy, a former top official of the bankrupt Reading Railroad, one of the first casualties of the panic, walked into Washington Park just north of the Midway and shot himself. Of course, he had been staying at the Metropole. He was the third of the hotel's guests to commit suicide that summer. Mayor Harrison warned that the ranks of the unemployed had swollen to an alarming degree. "If Congress does not give us money, we will have riots that will shake this country," he said. 2 weeks later, workers scuffled with police outside City Hall. It was a minor confrontation, but the Tribune called it a riot. A few days after that, on August 30th, 25,000 unemployed workers converged on the downtown lakefront and heard Samuel Gompers, standing at the back of Speaker's Wagon No. 5, ask, "Why should the wealth of the country be stored in banks and elevators while the idle workman wanders homeless about the streets and the idle loafers, who hoard the gold only to spend it in riotous living, are rolling about in fine carriages from which they look out on peaceful meetings and call them riots?" For the city's industrialists and merchant princes who learned of Gompers' speech in their Sunday morning newspapers, this was a particularly unsettling question, for it seemed to embody a demand for much more than simply work. Gompers was calling for fundamental change in the relationship between workers and their overseers. This was dangerous talk, to be suppressed at all costs. Prendergast. It was exciting, this prospect of becoming one of the city's most important officials. At last, Prendergast could leave behind the cold mornings and filthy streets and the angry newsboys who disobeyed him and taunted him. He was growing impatient, however. His appointment as corporation counsel should have occurred by now. One afternoon in the first week of October, Prendergast took a grip car to City Hall to see his future office. He found a clerk and introduced himself. Incredibly, the clerk did not recognize his name. When Prendergast explained that Mayor Harrison planned to make him the city's new corporation counsel, the clerk laughed. Prendergast insisted on seeing the current counsel, a man named Kraus. Certainly Kraus would recognize his name. The clerk went to get him. Kraus emerged from his office and extended his hand. He introduced Prendergast to the other men on his staff as his successor. Suddenly, everyone was smiling. At first, Prendergast thought the smiling was an acknowledgement that soon he would be in charge. But now he saw it as something else. Kraus asked if he'd like the position immediately. "No," Prendergast said. "I am in no hurry about it." Which was not true, but the question had thrown Prendergast. He did not like the way Kraus asked it. Not at all. Later, an alienist named Daniel R. Brower, former superintendent of the Eastern Lunatic Asylum, would testify that Kraus had erred in humoring Prendergast. By doing so, Dr. Brower said, Kraus had intensified Prendergast's delusion.